All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm looking at bandepletedurania.org. On the line is Doug Ware. He is the coordinator for the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons. Has worked on DEU for 6 years on both the UK and international campaigns. Again, the website, bandepletedurania.org. Welcome to the show, Doug. How are you?
Not so bad. Thank you for saving me a plug.
Oh, yeah, there you go. No, I mean, that's what the show is about, is recommending reading to people. And when I read this article this morning, concern grows over possible use of depleted uranium in Libya, I thought, hey, this is real journalism. And I hate to say it, but this is a subject that is prone to a lot of quackery and assertions without evidence, and it's mostly because the government does nothing but lie about it, so there's a giant void in the discussion that's filled with a lot of nonsense. And so I'm always very happy when I read something about depleted uranium that is, you know, written with, you know, obvious credibility and thoroughness and so forth, as this article is. So that's why you're here, is so that we can both help recommend people go read Concern Grows Over Possible Use of Depleted Uranium in Libya at bandepletedurania.org. And this article talks at first about the A-10s, which I guess it was the Washington Post report at first that they're using these A-10 warthogs in combat against Gaddafi's forces. And you talk about the likelihood that they are using machine gun rounds and perhaps bombs and missiles that are tipped with depleted uranium. Is that correct?
Well, we're talking about the ammunition rounds. There's actually very little evidence to substantiate the use of depleted uranium in bombs and missiles more generally. So this article is specifically about the ammunition and from two particular aircraft, primarily the A-10 Warthog or Thunderbolt, but also the Marine Harriers that have been operating from a ship off Libya. But these are the two things we're particularly concerned about at the moment.
Okay, and now, so tell us about the likelihood, because I guess you don't have any sources saying one way or the other yet here, but you say there are a couple of different rounds. You seem like you're very familiar with the kinds of weapons that these warthogs use, so how likely is it, do you think, that they're using these DU rounds, and can you tell us a little bit about the background of that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the Warthog was sort of developed in the 70s as a aircraft for attacking the tops of tanks in a Cold War scenario, and so they basically built an aircraft around an enormous cannon which fires either depleted uranium rounds, these are 30mm rounds, each of them with 300 grams of DU in them, or high explosive rounds, or a mixture of the two. In Iraq and in the Balkans, we saw that they were firing a mixture of the two. In Afghanistan, what we've seen suggests that they're just firing the high explosive rounds because they're not going after armored targets, which then leads us on to Libya, where clearly their role there, now that the air defenses have been knocked out by cruise missiles and fast jets, is to then attack armored personnel carriers and tanks for the Libyan forces on the ground. And this is a role which the US believe that DU is very well suited for. So we believe that there are significant chances that they're using DU. And the last official statement from the US government regarding DU was just prior to the A-10s arriving and going into action. So it's probably not still relevant at this stage. And there's been pretty much a blistering silence from the authorities over whether DU is being used. I mean, just looking at Google News, there are, what, 17,000 news articles mentioning that A-10s are in use in Libya, and of these, 7 actually mention that this aircraft fires depleted uranium. And so we're urgently trying to clarify the situation of the U.S. government to see whether this stuff's being fired or not.
All right, so for the context there, I think that really says something about the cannon of the A-10 and the kind of bullets that they're using, depleted uranium tip bullets, if with all of the precision guided laser JDAM sophisticated kind of weaponry that the American Air Force and the US Navy have at their disposal, that they still would use ground attack aircraft using machine gun cannons to take out armored targets. That must be a badass gun.
It fires around 4,000 rounds a minute. They don't actually fire for a minute. If they did, it would probably knock the aircraft out of the sky or tear it to pieces, I think. But as in the case of the Balkans, I mean, we visited sites in Kosovo where they'll have been attacked lasting, you know, a few seconds, and in that time, several hundred rounds of DU will have been fired, leading to, you know, 100 kilos, more than 100 kilos of DU contamination at a particular site. I mean, some of those rounds will lodge in the ground, and there's worries there over contamination of groundwater, contamination of agricultural fields. Others will, if they hit a hard target, kind of vaporize into a uranium dust, and then contaminate the surface. And if there are civilians nearby, there's risk of inhalational exposure. One thing we're really quite concerned about is that we've seen a lot of footage of the Libyan rebel forces stripping any vehicles they can get for parts, because obviously there's the arms embargo there, and they have very few operating vehicles themselves. So one of the sort of big risks which the US and UK governments both agree to is for people sort of returning to vehicles quite quickly after they've been hit by DU, and this could well be an issue for the Libyan rebels if they're going in stripping spare parts from these contaminated vehicles.
Wow. Well, you know, even if you just were to accept the premise for the sake of argument about the most humanitarian motives behind all this, I'm reminded of what Aldous Huxley said about how your means determine your ends, no matter what your lofty goal. And boy, it seems like it's pretty problematic, to have this kind of thing, because not only do we have, you know, the illnesses and things like that, and hopefully we can talk a bit about the cause and effect of that in the next segment, but it's there forever. It turns, as you said, into dust on impact with armor, I guess because of, the way those molecules are linked together. When it hits, it's a self-sharpening round. Instead of going dull, it gets sharper and sharper, which means that the outsides of it basically are peeled away, and you have these microscopic little pieces of this stuff, and there's no magnet in the world to clean it up with. I mean, we're talking about once you blow up a tank with this stuff, it's pretty much there until the half-life's over, long after the end of mankind or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, the experience from the Balkans, which we've reported on, we've got a fairly chunky report on that on our website under the publications section. But yeah, I mean, the Serbian government, they tried to clean up the 12 or so sites they had in southern Serbia, and they spent an absolute fortune, and they were very clear, and the United Nations Environment Program are very clear that you're never going to be able to remove all the contamination. You can remove a fair amount of solid penetrators, you can strip back top 2 meters of soil as they did, but then you're left with the issue of, well, what do you do with this contaminated soil, which technically would be classified as low-level waste, so then that has to be stored indefinitely. In Iraq, you know, we have a lot less information, and there's been a few studies done, but they've been very limited in scope. What we've seen there was that there's a very active trade in scrap metal, so this is almost similar to the spare parts stripping issue, that a lot of contaminated scrap metal was being dumped. Once it was eventually taken off the streets from civilian areas, it was being dumped in unprotected scrap yards. So you had these hotspots of contamination which were accessed. You know, kids love playing on messed up war material, and these people were being exposed. Now, there was nothing, you know, if this happened in the UK or the US, there'd be large fences and barbed wire around these sites. People wouldn't be allowed near them. These stuff would be dealt with. They'd be decontaminated. They'd go to low-level waste dumps. But in a state recovering from conflict, you know, that sort of requires a certain level of administration, which is very rarely in place. I mean, we see from the United Nations Environment Program, International Atomic Energy Agency, World Health Organization, there's still a lot of debate over health effects, but one thing they're very clear on is that stuff should be done after conflict to reduce the risk, and what we see time and time again is that this stuff simply isn't done. So that then sort of shifts the balance of how much of a risk these weapons are.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, to clean it up would be to acknowledge it's problematic to use it in the first place. Might as well just ignore it, I guess, from the point of view of the military and the empire. And so I was hoping that you could tell us a bit about the science of depleted uranium, because it's easy to say, oh, no, radioactive, cancer. I saw a Japanese monster movie just like that, and I don't like it, and things like that, but what's better is, you know, real substance. So I figured I'd give you a chance to really explain what is known, what is not known about the effects of depleted uranium poisoning on people.
Okay, well, depleted uranium itself is primarily an alpha emitter, so it emits alpha radiation. Alpha radiation itself can't actually penetrate the skin, but the issue with DU is that as you mentioned earlier, when these rounds hit a hard target, they burn into a fine dust. And so then if you inhale this dust, then you're taking in this radioactive source into your lungs, where it can then lodge for a long period, irradiating directly into the tissue. And therein lies the problem. There are huge uncertainties about the effects of low-level radiation emitters inside the body. And so this is a major problem. We also have the sort of twin issue that DU is chemically toxic, so like lead and other heavy metals, and it's been shown to be carcinogenic through both these routes. So then we sort of have we've got a huge amount of research, essentially the sort of animal studies and laboratory studies which you would do if you were trying to put a new cosmetic or a new medicine on the market, because obviously you can't test on human subjects. Had they had the same results for a commercial product, then it would never have reached the shelves, but somehow because it's a military weapon, then it sort of deserves a higher level of proof. It's been shown to be carcinogenic, and not just by some sort of wacko hippies in a laboratory somewhere, but by the US's own Armed Force Radiobiology Research Institute, who showed that it caused leukemia in mice. More recently, they've shown that DU exposure can cause sort of generational issues for the generation after the one that's been exposed. So this is just some of the sort of research we have, and there's, you know, a huge amount. There are also real big uncertainties about how DU behaves in the environment, and that's something we sort of saw reflected in some recent work we did at the UN, where the United Nations Environment Programme really called for a precautionary approach to the use of DU, which we think is entirely justified.
All right, now, let me play devil's advocate for a minute here. It's depleted uranium, after all. Here's, you take natural uranium ore, you spin it through a centrifuge, and you take out all the worst stuff. The 235 is the sweet stuff that you make a nuclear bomb with, and then this is the byproduct of that. So how radioactive could it really be? You know, I read a gigantic half-life, I forget the last number I saw, 80,000 years or something is the half-life of the thing, but doesn't that just mean it's not very radioactive?
That's 4.5 billion years, the half-life. I mean, yeah, you could argue that. You could say, well, it's less radioactive than sort of fresh natural uranium, but there's a couple of issues there. I mean, when you enrich uranium and create depleted uranium in the process, it's not depleted of all the uranium-235, plus uranium-238 on its own is also radioactive. And then the issue is that you can't sort of look at a radioactive isotope as this sort of stable thing. It's the whole sort of a lump of DU is constantly in motion with various radioactive decays. So why you can say, well, it has 60% of natural radioactivity of natural uranium when it comes straight out the enrichment plant, from that point onwards, the various isotopes inside it start to decay, and you produce sort of an increased level of radiation. But perhaps probably more fundamentally is that the natural uranium ore, which is always compared to, exists in a sort of rather sort of sparing state in the environment. You very rarely come across a lump of pure uranium ore, whereas DU is uranium, depleted uranium, is a sort of very enriched kind of lump of it. So, you know, this is the issue, really, and they often sort of say, well, we've looked at uranium miners, we've looked at other people, and they seem to be fine, but DU is a very sort of specific kind of contamination, and it's very difficult to draw very clear parallels with other scenarios where people may have been exposed to uranium.
Mm. All right, now, just as a parenthetical here, I'm looking at your website, banddepleteduranium.org, here, and there's a pretty extensive sidebar of links, and I wonder whether we can find resources about, for example, those animal studies you referred to. Do you have all that kind of documentation lined up at the site?
Yeah, under the resources bit, if you go down to scientific and then general papers, and there is somewhere down a review of the latest published papers of DU, and that's about a year and a half old, I think, and that's fully referenced details of a lot of the peer-reviewed studies that have come out lately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Well, we know there was one that came out in December and one that came out previously last July, 2010. And I talked then with one of the doctors who did the study, Dr. Christopher Busby. And one of the things that he mentioned was that aside from the alpha particles being emitted by the inhaled dust, beside from heavy metal poisoning of the human tissue cells, that there's one other effect that they, I think, you know, pretty well confirmed, to use Dick Cheney's phrase, I'm not exactly sure how positive, but something to the effect that the little bits of depleted uranium dust inside the human body actually serves sort of as an antenna for other radiation in the environment and tends to intensify it and retransmit it out to the body in that sense. Do you know about that, or do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've read Chris's papers suggesting that. I'm not a sort of expert on internal radioactive emitters, but I know that there's still a lot of discussion and a lot of debate as to whether that is actually a genuine effect. But I'm probably not super qualified to comment more on that, I think.
Well, one thing is for sure is that these weapons should be banned. And it's hilarious. I saw actually on mute over here out of the corner of my eye this morning on MSNBC, Obama giving a big lecture about how all private businesses need to go green and this and that when he's the biggest polluter on the face of the earth. And I guess, again, we don't know for sure that they're using depleted uranium rounds in Libya. But as you say, it's the right kind of targets that they do arm A-10s with these sort of bullets for. And why wouldn't they? You know, it's certainly a danger. And something that, you know, again, is a pretty permanent thing. What do you say, a billion-year half-life? This is something that...
A half a billion years.
I think that's all.
The U.S. government is actually quite sensitive to the EU. I mean, you know, it's a very sort of natural human response when I sort of speak to people who've never heard of it before, and they're sort of aghast that this is being used in weapons. And then there's obviously a very sort of deep human response to exposure to radioactivity as well. And when the weapons were first sort of developed back in the 70s, there was a very clear acceptance from the U.S. that these wouldn't really be acceptable. And so they had to make a very, very compelling case for their utility that, you know, they couldn't get by without these weapons. And that still continues to be the case. The UK took a slightly different approach by just trying to be as transparent as possible, but always sort of sticking to this utility line that we need these weapons to protect our boys and et cetera, et cetera. And there is sort of, you know, the US is kind of trying to kind of move away from DU in some of the calibers. So in these medium caliber rounds of the Type 5 by the A-10, we've seen stuff to suggest that, you know, they're looking for alternatives. With the new Joint Strike Fighter, for the contracts, the ammunition for that, they're very clear that they don't want depleted uranium for the ammunition. So there is this acceptance. There is kind of a bit of a groundswell. I mean, we've had repeated UN resolutions on this issue, most recently last year, which was supported by 148 states, which was calling on the users of DU, specifically UK and US, to identify the locations where they fired them in Iraq, because that's one sort of huge problem and a huge bar to actually doing sort of meaningful research on the ground and also to do decontaminating, is that the US hasn't told anybody where it's fired 400 odd tons. That's European tons, so 400,000 kilos of DU in Iraq over the two conflicts. And, you know, if this was landmines or cluster munitions, people would be up in arms, but for some reason the US kind of sort of got away with just not mentioning where it's fired these weapons, despite all these sort of august scientific bodies saying one of the first things you should do is identify these locations, warn the local people, and in areas where there's high contamination, spend a lot of money and decontaminate these sites. So we're noticing this. You know, we've had European Parliament resolutions. We're starting to get national bans on these weapons. Most countries around the world, their militaries who, you know, to be fair, the US very rarely goes into war on its own. They tend to not be very comfortable with the use of these weapons. The service personnel certainly aren't. So, I don't know, there is, I think, a general sort of shift, and we're going in the right direction. But what we really need is for campaigners and activists to really just stick to the facts and stick to the reality and just step back from all the hyperbole about these weapons and see them as what they are, which is, you know, a dirty weapon system which isn't essential. It isn't some enormous conspiracy. It can be dealt with through campaigning means.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate all the information and your efforts. I'm just getting familiar with this website, but it looks like a really great resource here. BanDepletedUranium.org. Get involved there. Learn all about DU there. Thank you very much for your time on the show today, Doug Ware.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest.